Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. If you have lived through revolution anywhere in the world, call us up with lessons for the people in Egypt right now. Tom in Morristown. Whoops, Tom disappeared. All right, let's try Manu in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
I was born in Iran, and I lived through the first revolution or series of uprisings, which ended up in deposing Mossadegh in 1953.
That's when the Shah came to power.
That's when the Shah was restored to power.
Yes.
I can talk about that a long time, but please be my editor. But let me, after that, of course, I followed the Iranian revolution here in the United States. And I also became, after Papa Doc died in Haiti and the country opened to foreigners, I went to Haiti many times. I was involved in Haitian art. Mm-hmm. And I also followed the... And just to be short, I think without a civil society, it's impossible to go from a dictatorship to a democracy, because dictatorships have different rules. Democracy has different rules. It would be equivalent to taking football players, American football players, taking off their helmets, putting them in shorts and T-shirts, giving them a round ball, putting them in a soccer field and say, okay, go to it. They will kill each other. The rules are different. The rules have to be different, and they have to be learned. And I learned my first lesson when I was in United States at NYU. We tried to form an Iranian students' association. Mm-hmm. And it immediately broke into factions and people screaming at each other and almost like tea parties. And
So how might they do this in Egypt or in Tunisia now?
Well, if they are very lucky, it should happen slowly, with a lot of goodwill, and obviously the people who have been at the top, slowly moving out, trying to get some little bit of honor for themselves, because. I also posted this, but I have to repeat it. I think in my lifetime, people in Egypt had only one chance to have a decision as to who would be their governor, who would be the president. That was when Gamal Abdel Nasser started the Six-Day War. At the end, he said that he would resign. And the people of Egypt, instead of helping him pack, came out into the streets and they said, no, we want you.
Manu, I will leave it there. Thank you very much. And we go next to Harry in Queens. Lesson
Hi.
From South Africa. Yes, Harry?
Hi. I'm actually black American, but I lived in South Africa. And watched the transition in 1993 and 1994. And the thing is, it was much, much more violent than any, you know, most people in America. It was horrendous, you know. Something like 30,000 casualties, street fighting. A faction of the ANC was really convinced that they could do what happened in East Germany. They tried to rush a homeland government, and they were pretty much massacred. But what really worked there, and I'm not sure it's transferable, is that the lawyers were the heroes in South Africa. All the communities are incredibly legalistic. It's like mind-numbingly legalistic. In South Africa. And they turned it over to the lawyers, and as this horrendous violence was going on, you know, black, white, Asian, colored lawyers just sat down and hammered out a constitution. The far right wing actually crashed a tank into the negotiating chamber. That's how bad it was. But they just kept going. And I don't know that other countries are as legalistic as South Africans are.
But you're saying a focus on the law can help with the transition.
Yes, it's a legalistic culture, and all the cultures have the same mentality that you know, it's hammered out in the law, but I'm not sure that other...
That it's transferable. Harry, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Ahmed in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello.
From Nepal?
Yes.
And tell us...
I was a child when the revolution happened, but they thrown out the monarchy, active monarchy there, and after the revolution, there's a struggle between the parties, the political parties, and that was worse than the one authoritarian rule because it messed up. Then still, after two decades, we don't have a stable government over there.
So that was 1990, that overthrow,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
And two decades later, there's still no stable government.
Yeah, because after there's like a lot of political parties and there's a power struggle between them, and there's like one after one corrupt government, there's like a lot of corrupt government, it on and on. So there's still like the same thing. I might fear like same thing might happen to any other countries, like Egypt or. After the one government goes, the other government, there's a lot of powers. There might be a power struggle between other parties.
Is there a way to prevent it that you think you would recommend from the Nepalese experience, or is that too complicated?
Yeah, it's complicated, but they have to be careful. They don't want the organization or the political parties to give more authority. What the Nepalese people did in 1990, they gave full authority to the political parties. They believe 100% in them. That should not happen. They should not believe 100%. There should be a check and balance in every government. They might be corrupt or they might be not like the other. They might not be like the authoritarian government. So there should be check and balance with each government.
Thank you very much. As we collect your stories from revolutions anywhere in the world with the lessons for the people in the Middle East right now. Anne in Hoboken, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. I lived in Greece before the Papadopoulos revolution and then throughout the student uprisings and the king's attempt to flee, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Late 60s? And, yes, 1967, and I don't remember, 72, or I don't remember the exact years, but... The tanks would roll in, everybody would look up, you know, oh, look what's happening, go back to their, you know, walking their babies in the park, because they knew that everything was just going to change. There would be dictatorship, then the king, then a democracy, then dictatorship, and they were all expecting it, and nothing really changed. And I thought it might change when they joined the European Union, but I noticed they're still not paying their taxes, you know, they're still in this... culture of not taking responsibility for their society, and nothing changes really until you do that.
Is there a lesson?
Yeah. Take part in your society and make it work, and don't just be in it for yourself all the time. Think about, I guess it's the importance of politics, really, how it really matters how your government is run. And instead of just trying to find ways around the law, take responsibility for yourself, and then there will be some stability.
Anne, thank you very much. And Jose Luis in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. I thought that my experiences as a child in Cuba might shed a little bit of light on what's going on in Cairo right now.
Go ahead.
Well, at the triumph of the revolution, it was really the triumph of an extremely broad coalition of all kinds of views and groups, and mostly social democrats, mostly urban people. And Castro formed basically only a small minority. He was charismatic. He was very media savvy. He was very manipulative. He had a great television presence. But the vast majority of the support for the revolution came from all social classes and mostly very democratic. But as the first year of the revolution, went through its paces, little by little, all the coalition groups started dropping out because the Castro group was able to seize power and basically pull a Bolshevik type of revolution where you lost the consensus and opponents began to be exiled or jailed.
So how do you think they could have...
Tremendous euphoria and feeling of well-being and almost like a rebirth.
Do you see echoes of it, the early phases of it in Egypt right now?
Well, what I see, at least portrayed in the media, is a very literate, a very highly educated middle class that probably doesn't reflect the vast majority of the Egyptian fellaheen, but at least they represent the same kind of urban social element that feels it's more advanced. It's an advanced stage of political democracy, but really is a little naive and doesn't understand that people like the Muslim Brotherhood were probably are more organized and poised to seize power from them and snatch that feeling of euphoria from them.
Jose Luis, thank you so much. Hold on for a minute. My producer wants to ask you a question. Bela in Stamford, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello. I'd like to share some experiences which I lived through during the Hungarian Revolution.
1956.
And one of the things we've done was to spontaneously form a national guard. And that way we made sure that no unlawful activities would occur. And the members of the National Guard were self-appointed. And all we did was to put an armband on our arms consisting of the national colors.
To protect against local violence?
Local violence,
petty crime,
stealing,
looting,
that sort of thing. The other thing we've done was to announce on the radio that farmers should bring food to the cities and distribute it free of charge so that people would have something to eat. The other thing we've done was to place collection boxes on the street corners where people who have money could put it in there and those who needed it for burial expenses or anything else could take it out from it.
How long did it last before the Soviets crushed it?
Actually, we won the first round. In other words, we beat the secret police. By the way, we invented the Molotov cocktail. and we also beat the occupational forces of the Russians because their tanks had the gasoline tanks on the outside of the tanks. So we could throw the Molotov cocktails and burn them out.
Bela, I'm going to leave it there, and thank you very much for calling. And maybe we'll see you at our Green Space event next week. Thanks to all of you. As I said, this is a start of a conversation we're going to have between now and next Friday, and you hear how moving and diverse the lessons are from these various parts of the world. So let me just tell you that we are producing a special Brian Lehrer Show broadcast from WNYC's Green Space for a week from today, next Friday, the 11th. And we're going to be gathering Egyptian and other North African and Arab New Yorkers to discuss the uprisings. And we will invite people like our callers from today, scholars, journalists, regular folks who have studied or been witness to revolutions and their aftermaths from anywhere around the world. This is going to be a truly fascinating international/New York event, we believe. And we have a limited number of tickets available for $10, and they're on sale now. A lot of the seats are going to be taken up by these folks who are going to represent their various revolutions. And we have some tickets for sale at $10 in case you're interested. Go to thegreenspace.org for tickets and details, thegreenspace.org. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We will finish up on the lighter side today, coming up after a short break, and you can start calling now. Your Super Bowl watching rituals and your Super Bowl avoiding rituals. We want some of each. Don't be offended if we bump you to keep some lines open. We want your Super Bowl watching rituals and your Super Bowl avoiding rituals. We have a friend who stacks couches on top of each other to replicate bleachers. What's your Super Bowl watching ritual? What's your Super Bowl avoiding ritual? 212-433-9692. Those calls after this.